This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for August 19th, 2014. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. I'm Drew Messenger Michaels. Thank you, as always, for being here. Okay, here's what happened. On May 11th, 1996, Garry Kasparov, inarguably one of the best chess players alive at the time, and some would argue the greatest chess player of all time, played a six-game match against a computer opponent created by IBM, called Deep Blue. And he lost. There was some drama after that. Kasparov accused IBM of cheating, possibly because he was freaked out by the computer's 44th move during the first game, which he said was way too inventive, way too human, basically, to have legitimately originated in a machine. Nate Silver has argued that the move was probably the result of a bug in the program, which is interesting for any number of reasons. But that weirdness aside, most people agree that in 1996, a computer beat a human grandmaster at chess fair and square. There are a couple of ways you can react to an event like that, to a piece of information like that. First, you could go sensationalist, and boy, oh boy, did people go sensationalist at the time. You could say that there was no hope now, right? This was an outright victory of machine intelligence over human intelligence. Computers are now officially smarter than us. They will inevitably take over. The ride is over for us monkeys, et cetera, right? Alternately, you could come to the conclusion that computers are better at certain aspects of chess. Computers will always be better at sorting and cross-referencing huge swaths of information and predicting outcomes and so on, but humans are still better and will probably always be better at reading each other, at guessing and bluffing and engaging in more intuitive and inventive forms of thinking. That, by the way, was basically Kasparov's view, and he used it to develop a concept that people had been kicking around since the 1970s, what if a human and a computer played chess together, into what he called advanced chess. So, in advanced chess, each team or each cyborg player, depending on how you conceive of it, is composed of a human and a computer, and the humans can consult the computers and look at possible outcomes and look at the history of chess and all that, and it is the responsibility of the human operant or the human component of the cyborg or what have you to make those sorts of intuitive leaps, right? So the result, most people would agree, is chess that is a little bit more wild, a little bit less safe, a little bit, for lack of a better term, more interesting, right? Okay. So there is, of course, a third conclusion you could come to as a result of a computer beating an exceptionally skilled human at chess. You could come to the possibly blasphemous conclusion that maybe, just maybe, there is room for improvement in the rule set of chess itself. If the game as it stands rewards the things that computers are good at, like rote memorization and cross-referencing, at least as much as it rewards the things humans are good at, like creative thinking and reading your opponent, then maybe we can improve the rules to emphasize the parts that are more human. There was this game called Arima that sought to do just that. You can play it with a regular chess board, but it's designed from the ground up to be harder for a computer than for a human. That's one chess variation among literally thousands, but it belongs to a subset of chess variations that address themselves to the question of what we might be able to improve about chess. So there's this other game called Chess 2, made by a guy named David Serlin. And, you know, the name is cheeky, but he also means it. By which I mean, Chess 2 is an iterative sequel to chess. It seeks to take the interesting things about the original, the fact that it involves deep strategic thinking and that it's non-random, and also improve upon or eliminate those things that are not interesting about chess, the emphasis on memorization, and also, he pointed out, the tendency of chess games to end in ties, or more specifically, stalemates. Chess 2 tries to address some of those issues. There's a new win condition. If you get your king across the center of the board, even if you don't capture your opponent's king, you win. And there's also this double-blind betting mechanic, where depending on which piece is capturing which piece, you can bid in secret these stones. pieces, and it allows you to sort of guess how much each piece is worth to your opponent, get them to waste their resources, use your resources interestingly. You can get more stones by capturing pawns, and it introduces this, you know, economics of warfare aspect that's interesting. It also is not necessarily symmetrical, Chess 2. There are multiple armies you can use. There's actually six of them total. So all of these changes create a very different game, a faster-paced game, and a game with a different vector of strategy. Which brings me, finally, to this week's guest, Zach Burns. He and his studio, Ludim Games, they're responsible for the digital adaptation of Chess 2, which came out a while ago on Ouya, will be coming out soon on iPad, and is available as of today on Steam. So, we talk a little bit about why Ouya is a great place to start, especially as a first-time indie developer, but then why coming to Steam can be necessary. We talk a bit about the special character of the Ouya audience. I almost said character. Why was that? That was interesting. Anyway, we talk about that. We talk about intellectual property law, the strangeness of adapting something that is in the public domain, like chess, into something that's not, like Chess 2. We talk about all sorts of things. It's a bit of a slow burn, I must say. The conversation takes a while to get going, and I talk more than I meant to. It reminds me a little bit of my conversation with Davey Reedon of Stanley Parable fame in that way, but like that conversation, it does end up in some very worthwhile places, I would say. So, without further ado, here is Zach Burns.
Hey, Drew, how you doing?
Very good, how are you?
Very good.
Thank you very much for taking the time, by the way. And also, welcome to the U.S., I think is an appropriate thing to say.
Yes, thank you. Yes. It's very nice. Although we were met with a huge rainstorm on our first day, and now also on Independence Day, but it's still good to be home.
Absolutely. What city are you in? I know you're on the East Coast, if you don't mind my asking.
Yeah, I'm in Claremont, New Hampshire. Claremont.
Okay. Yeah, I know New Hampshire. Okay. My folks are both from the East Coast. My dad is from Long Island. My mom is from East Providence, Rhode Island. So.
Oh, very nice.
Real quick, first off the bat, I would love to get this from you. If you had to describe Chess 2 to somebody who had no idea what it was or thought it was kind of a one-off joke or whatever, how would you describe it?
So it's all the things that you love about chess amplified. So if you like positional play, there's more opportunities to explore that. If you like studying strategic imbalances, there's more opportunity to play with that. But it's less of the things that are kind of bothersome about chess, or less of the things that make chess harder to get into. Like there's less memorization of openings, there's less memorization of endgames, things like that. So it's just taking all the good stuff about chess and making it better, and then removing things that aren't as fun or are not what chess promises to be. Like it promises to be a strategic game. And memorization is not very strategic, right? So it removes that stuff.
Sure. That's interesting that you start with the sales pitch to somebody who is way, way into chess, because to me the sales pitch is more obvious to someone who likes the idea of chess but could never get that into it. And I kind of put myself in that category, right? Like, not that I don't enjoy playing, but the element of memorization, the element of just sort of aping the strategies of people who are much, much better than me, and the lack of flexibility and the sort of fanatical symmetry of it all always turned me off a bit. So to me, it feels like it's a long overdue sequel, right? But that it seems to me, at least intuitively, that might be less obvious to someone who's very, very serious about let's call it Chess 1, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it might be hard to I haven't thought about it, explaining it very much to people who aren't into Chess 1 as much. I don't know, I've got kind of the curse of knowledge there, you know, if you're familiar with the term.
Sure, yeah, definitely, definitely. Why you know, so your role or your studio's role is to adapt this to a digital form, right? The game was originally designed, correct me if I'm wrong, to be played with, you know, an actual chess set or a couple of actual chess sets, more accurately.
That's true.
So
just one.
Or just one, right? Isn't it? So with the asymmetrical armies, can you play it with just one Chess 1 set, or do you need to mix and match a bit?
You just need one set. The only thing that you would need in addition to that are some stones, like some pennies or what have you.
Gotcha, gotcha. Is that for the betting and risk reward element, or is that to fill in
yes,
for?
it is.
Yeah, gotcha, gotcha. Could you talk?
Yes, not betting. It's bidding, which is quite a bit different than betting.
So talk me through the difference there, because I understand that there is a difference, but I'm an idiot, so help me out with.
So the word betting to me brings to mind things like gambling, right, where you're taking chance or there's a luck element, right? But bidding is more in this term, or as it is for chess too, and for like bidding for an auction, right, where there's not actually luck involved in an auction. It's just a valuation question. Right? How do you evaluate this position? How do you evaluate your pieces in the context of the board? And then there's a double-blind auction that happens there, but there's no actual luck element. So that's why I would prefer the term bidding over betting.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And after all, what people like about Chess 1 and presumably Chess 2 is the rather fanatical lack of luck, that everything is sort of hypothetically predictable, assuming that you have the presence of mind and or the knowledge of the systems to anticipate it.
Right. And chess, too, is also a game of complete information in the game theory sense, in the same way that chess 1 is, and that it keeps that element.
So why did you decide to adapt it into digital form? Was it an opportunity that presented itself that you found irresistible? Did you pursue it? What made you think it would be suited well to that as opposed to whipping out a chess 1 set and some pennies or whatever and just playing it on a tabletop?
Right, so I really enjoyed the Chess 2 game, and in general, I think that board games should stay board games and not actually be converted to the digital realm, because there's something that is lost there with the interaction of the people involved on the board, right? But with Chess 2, I really enjoyed the game design, and I had difficulty finding opponents. I feel that this game is more of a competitive game than is like a casual board game with several players, right? So it's actually more important, I think, here to be able to have access to a wide player base than it is to preserve that person-to-person interaction. So that's why I wanted to make it a digital board game, was just so that I would have a wider base of players to challenge, right?
Sure, that makes complete sense. Well, I know that was also part of the motivation behind the digital version of Hive, for example, or other kind of, you know, newer... Well, that's Hive is a boardless board game, right? But tabletop games. The idea that reaching a wider audience and being able to find an opponent and share strategies sort of outweighed the visceralness that you could hypothetically lose.
Right. I think that Chess 2 falls into that category as well. Where that's very valuable. And you still can play in real life if you want to.
Of course, of course. No, it's not. Yeah. It's not as though we're going to foreclose on the possibility of playing physically once the digital version is out. I hope that would be kind of an insidious
right.
plan if that were your plan. But yeah. So what do you think is lost though when it's not a tabletop? Is it just the obvious stuff like looking somebody in the eye, or do you think it sort of changes the pace or the feel of play in subtler ways when you have a physical piece or a series of pieces in your hand?
Well, for me personally, when playing other chess games online, I found that I didn't play as well on those, and I find that a lot of players actually, a lot of good players prefer to use the 2D sets when playing on the computer, but they use 3D sets when playing in person, right? And that's kind of an odd thing, right? You'd think that they would, if playing with a 3D set was better, like they do in person, then they would want to do that on the computer. Or if playing with 2D pieces was better, then they'd want to do that in person, right? Like tournaments, you don't have players playing with paper cutouts, right? That'd be weird.
Right.
So I felt that with a lot of chess games, something was really lost there, and so I really tried with Chess 2 to make sure that ability to feel like the chess set is really there, and getting an idea of where all the pieces are from looking at the three-dimensional set was preserved. So I spent a lot of time on like the lighting and look and feel to make it really look like the chess set is a real set and really has that sense of depth and sense of position for the pieces. So I think that most of what would be lost there has been preserved in terms of like look and feel. And also, there is a bit lost, perhaps, with the bidding, right? There's an element of a mind game there of anticipating what your opponent is going to do. So maybe a little bit of that is lost because you can't look them in the eye, like you said. But more is gained as well. If you're playing with a traditional chess set, then you won't have access to these custom sculpts like the chess 2 elephant on the Ouya version looks like a real elephant, right? Or looks like an elephant piece rather. And there are custom sculpts for every unique piece in the game for every army that have been done in the style of the Staunton chess sets. So I think that there's a lot gained to kind of overcome the bit that's lost there.
That's great. Yeah, so I'm really excited to try it out. It's one of the games that I have been bummed I haven't been able to try because of my lack of an Ouya. It's a longer list than people might realize once you start looking into it. I mean, Towerfall is currently a big hit on Steam, and that was kind of a perceived system seller on the Ouya side, right? So first of all, what motivated your decision to release on Ouya first, or maybe as far as you were concerned at the time, only on Ouya? And then what made you sort of decide to branch out to iPad and Steam? Was it just a larger audience, or was there something more specific that those platforms do that the Ouya hypothetically does not?
Okay, so I started out on Ouya just because it is the most developer-friendly console out there, right? And it was at the time of the Kickstarter, and it kind of still is. It's difficult to get your foot in the door with PlayStation or Xbox, even still, although they've made big strides toward making that more accessible towards small developers. They're still not where the Ouya is, where anyone can become a developer and anyone can publish. So that was a big motivator there. The reason that I went to iPad and Steam is that, as I kept hearing what you said before over and over again, is that a lot of people want to try the game and they just don't have an Ouya. And if Chess 2 is the only thing that they wanted to buy on the Ouya, then it's kind of a tough sell to spend $100 for one game, although some people did actually. So of course I want the game to reach as wide an audience as possible. And the iPad is going to be really great for the kind of on-the-go nature of the new correspondence asynchronous play, and getting push notifications when it's your turn and things like that. So it'll have some features there that are working really well with the iPad and Steam. If we have the bandwidth to do it, I'd love to do integration with Steam Workshop, for example, to give players the ability to make custom puzzles for the game and add new content that way, beyond the normal kind of things that people do with Steam Workshop, which is like add hats or something. It can really add
That elephant could
something.
really use a hat, I think, but you know.
Yeah, that elephant could use a hat. No. I really believe in that the adding puzzles would really add a lot of value, and crowdsourcing that would be great for the community, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So they have some features there that we can really take advantage of, and they're also just have really wide player bases. So even still, though, I would encourage developers to consider going to the Ouya first if they want to test their game and see. For a smaller player base, how well it works out. I think the Ouya player base is probably more forgiving, and it's a good way to get feedback on your game before releasing to a wider audience.
Now that's interesting. The idea that the Ouya player base has a specific character and that character is more forgiving, as you say, and maybe better for particularly first-time developers. Is that because the kind of people who would buy an Ouya are kind of self-selecting, maybe indie game evangelists or just like people who are on board with interesting new ideas? Or is it something more architectural about the way the system itself works, or maybe both?
Maybe both. I mean, the system is very do it yourself or moddable and whatnot. So a lot of the people there would have an understanding of what goes into making a game, and a lot of the games published to the Ouya are kind of niche indie titles. So the person who's looking at an Ouya at this point would probably be interested in a lot of smaller or independent game development things.
Sure, that makes sense. That makes sense. So what do you play generally? I like asking people who have a toe both in the tabletop world and in the digital world this. Do you mostly play tabletop games? Do you have a healthy mix of that and digital? What's your game diet as a rule?
Let's see. I do love tabletop games. I don't get the opportunity to play them as much as I'd like to. So I've been playing mostly digital games recently. Just recently, off the top of my head, one that I liked a lot was Monument Valley. And I got to show that to my dad recently, which was cool because that game really has a lot of interesting ideas, but it's very accessible. And there are very few games that really have that crossover, which can demonstrate the value of games as a medium and yet be something that pretty much anyone can pick up and play. So I really like that one. I'm looking forward to The Witness on PS4, which is going to be kind of a similar category. I love Jonathan Blow's design sense. I love the way that he architects puzzles. But I think Braid maybe was harder in that accessibility category. You can't just give it to someone who doesn't play games and say, this is why games are interesting, because they'll fall in the pit a lot and have to rewind, and it'll just be kind of frustrating for them. Whereas someone who has platformy skills would be really focusing on what makes that game unique and interesting. So I think that The Witness is going to be really interesting. Yeah, that's off the top of my head.
It's a smart choice, I think, on Jonathan Blow's part to ape Myst instead of Mario this time around, because Myst was successful the first time around, specifically for what the reasons you're saying. You don't need those twitch reactions. You don't need that fluency in very very video gamey concepts like jumping on monsters and stuff to get into it, right? So that seems like the next logical step for his project, if he can be said to have a project, I guess.
Yeah, I really like his choices there.
Yeah, so it's an interesting time for yeah. I mean, there so I'm thinking about Blue Line Games when I think about people who I mentioned Hive earlier, right? But their whole deal is to adapt tabletop games to digital form, and I think they share your skepticism with that as a rule, right? The idea that it's easy to do it wrong, but it's happening more and more, and it's been an interesting gateway drug for some people. Like I've definitely got some friends who invited me over, booted up the Xbox version of Carcassonne, and then the next time I came over, they had Carcassonne, right? Like in the flesh. So is your goal partially the gateway drug aspect, or was it more just this is a standalone project, could work well digitally, and ought to exist in that form as well?
I'm not sure I completely understand the question. Can you
Fair.
repeat that?
Yeah. No, I guess my question is, with digital games being more and more widespread and sort of accepted into people's, understanding of what media they ought to consume, do you feel at all that part of your goal is to evangelize for tabletop games? Or is it more just, here's an interesting design, I'd like as many people to see it as possible, I'd like to do interesting things with it?
Okay, so I might have a long-winded answer to this question. So I talked a bit before that I don't really feel that board games should be transferred to video games because of that which is lost, right? Like if you're going to make a board game, in general, some reasons that you should make a board game are one, that's way cheaper to make a board game than a video game, right? Like if you're going to make a video game that's about flashcards, just make flashcards because that's really cheap. It doesn't take years and years of teams of people to program and do art for or something like that. And any particular experience should utilize the strengths of that medium, right? Like a lot of board games were created to utilize the strengths of the visceralness, the player interaction, things like this. And then they feel really dead to me on a console because they just weren't made for that. Or like books to movies, or movies to books, or those kind of conversions, or video games to movies are some of the worst examples, right?
Sure, yeah.
Transfers just don't do well. But what I would like to see more is for games to adapt some of the design sensibility that board games have. Board games have been evolving for a long time, and they've kind of figured out a way to do certain things that video games haven't done yet, like how to transfer the information of the rules of the game, for example. Like I'd love to see video games have maybe like a little rules reference card or something like that pop up when you need to, or I don't know, just some of the design sensibilities that they have. But I'd like to see the strength of the video game medium play out as well, because there are a lot of strengths there that board games don't have. But you asked about where looting games was going to go in the future. And I feel that our role is to use video games in a way that hasn't been done before, that's really a strength of the medium. And I think that that is actually going to be education. So with games as education, a lot of the examples that we've seen so far are pretty poor, in my opinion, and they don't utilize the strengths of games, and they often teach subjects that are easily learned by book or another kind of experience. But I think that there are certain kinds of things, certain subjects, for example, maybe language learning or physics or things like that, which actually games are uniquely suited to teaching in a way that books or flashcards or whatever else actually would not be able to do very well. And we are not able to do very well. Learning a language right now takes a long time. But can you imagine, like, if there was a game that was kind of a Metroidvania, where instead of getting items to unlock doors or something like that, the way that you would progress in the game was by demonstrating knowledge of the language. And a game system can do a lot of things that even like a private tutor couldn't do. It could keep track of how well you're remembering various words and present to you words that you have forgotten. It can create a hierarchical system of knowledge where, like, you could explore different areas of the game and make sure that all of that is based on things that you've already known, but really challenges you. It can adapt to how quickly you're learning things. It can do a lot that I think that traditional learning methods can't do. So maybe that's where looting games is going in the future.
Interesting. Yeah, now so there have been games sort of like what you describe, and if you feel that they've all sort of done it inartfully, then that's totally valid, of course. But I'm thinking specifically of like Mario Is Missing for the Super Nintendo, where it was, there were very, very light Mario platform type elements. You stomped on Koopas, but also every level was a real world city, and you couldn't advance without demonstrating some real world knowledge, which you could learn from the game or just know about that city, right? History, geography, etc. And it In that case, there
That's
was a pretty
yeah,
severe,
don't
not to interrupt
I
you, I was just going to say there was a pretty severe disconnect in that case between what you were doing moment to moment on screen and what the game wanted you to learn.
Yes, and that I think is inexcusably bad. That's not you really utilizing the strengths of the medium at all. And that's another case where you should just make flashcards because that's cheaper and faster. Why did you go through all the effort of putting this thing around the learning that hasn't that's not connected to it at all?
Right.
Whereas, like, what a game would be good at teaching is something that has a system, and that you need to interact with this system to demonstrate the learning. So maybe, like, build there are kind of sort of an example of this is like a bridge building game. I've seen these before. These are kind of learning games where you could learn about different bridge architectures and try things out and see how they crash and burn, right? You can't actually do that with a textbook. You can't do that with any other medium, except for games. And this game is doing it well because you are actually designing and building a bridge and seeing what happens when a truck goes over it, right? Like, that's kind of a better example, I think, of ways that games can do learning that in a way that nothing else can, in a way that we should take games in the future, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I begin to picture something a bit more than like Kerbal Space Program, which has taught me a fair bit about physics by letting me construct rockets incorrectly and blow little guys up. Not that I intended to do that, but it happened quite a lot. So I see what you mean. The idea of letting you get your hands dirty with a concept is definitely something games do well. I wonder, it's a bit less intuitive anyway, right? Like I'm certain it can be done, but it's a bit less intuitive when it comes to the humanities, when it comes to history or language or things like that. You know, physics are something that games have been putting a lot of effort towards simulating accurately or richly for quite a while, in the AAA space and elsewhere, where historical systems are something that, not that there aren't games that do that, of course, but there's a little bit less of an immediate connection between the player poking at something and seeing the results. There are definitely games like Civilization or like Crusader Kings 2, you know, for the micro and macro examples that let you poke at the rules of history, but they're maybe a little bit less directly connected to a real world analogy than a bridge builder game or than Kerbal Space Program is.
Right. Well, I don't think that all kinds of learning should really be taken over by games. I think that some kinds of learning are best suited to books or lecture, and some kind of learning are better suited toward simulation and games. One thing that I would like to see come from games about history that I that and the way that history was taught to me, I didn't feel was really what I needed to learn from history, is that I felt that in history class, I was kind of learning a bunch of disconnected facts, like names of people and wars and dates and things. And they didn't really have a lot of meaning to me. They just kind of felt like this is a list of things that I need to know for a test. What I feel is much more valuable about the history lessons are ideas and their consequences, right? Like, what kind of interesting ideas came from populations? Why did they happen? And then what were the results of those new ideas? Right, I think that that kind of perspective would be more interesting for history for me personally. I think that's something that maybe games could explore. We're far from being able to do that. We're like giving a population ideas in a game and then seeing how that changes them. But if we could get there, that would be really neat. So maybe that would be something for someone to do.
Yeah, definitely. That's a yeah. I'm wondering what that even looks like. And it's obviously, as you say, it's something that doesn't quite exist yet. But I imagine it's something a bit like Dwarf Fortress, in the sense that it's simulating a lot of possible variables. But you know, instead of going down to the individual organ level for a person, you're going down to the individual conversation level for a population and seeing how ideas spread. Is that sort of what you're describing?
Yeah, something like that. Or another thing that just came to mind right now that actually may already kind of be this is like the Democracy 3 game, where you play a elected official and you're creating policy decisions, and there are a bunch of voters in a network that have different ideas, and these changing policies has kind of a rippling effect over all the different areas of politics, like agriculture and public opinion and intercultural relationships, right? All these things are all connected in this game in ways that they kind of are in real life, and you can kind of play with that system, and maybe that will give you some ideas about how things interact in real life in a way that is not as easily grokkable through a book or something, or like a table or who knows what.
Sure.
So that might be an interesting idea.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I mentioned Crusader Kings too. I think Paradox's games tend to try to do what you're describing, right? And I don't know if you're, you know, too familiar with those, you know, Europa Universalis games and Crusader Kings and all that. And if you feel they succeed to some degree at what you're describing, but that's definitely an attempt that's out there.
Right, I'm not familiar with those.
Okay, yeah. They just attempt to richly, like, here's a map of Europe in 1066. It's basically accurate. See what you can do to change history in a way that's interesting to you. That's kind of the premise there, right? So yeah, so that, but with a perhaps more expansive view of what in fact can be changed, and also what's ticking under the hood, that it's not just stat checks against various cultures and rulers and such, but that it's actually, you know, working hard to simulate an actual philosophical system interacting with an actual economic system and seeing what may happen there.
Yeah, that would be really cool.
Yeah, I'd play that.
Yeah, me too. So the thing that's on my mind right now for what Ludum Games' next game might be, I haven't told other people this yet. So the next game that I see Ludum Games doing probably would be a quantum mechanics simulator, because this is something that I read about and I don't really understand. But I feel that by playing with quantum mechanics, by observing photons interacting, by trying out different things that I might be able to have a better understanding of this, right? Right now, there are a lot of games that kind of claim to do something about quantum mechanics, but they really fall short in actually simulating real quantum interactions. They'll do something silly like, if you're looking from the box in this direction, it looks like one thing, and if you're looking from the box in the other direction, it looks like something else.
Sure, sure.
That really has nothing to do with quantum mechanics at all. But I'd like to do a game based on that, where the way of building this game is probably just going to first be building the simulation itself, and then playing with it and see what interesting things I can find that come out of this game, and then making a series of puzzles, perhaps, that would lead the player to discover those interesting things on their own as well. So, like, the point there, the puzzle would have a goal, and by accomplishing this goal, you have to do things in a certain way that lead you to find this interesting interaction of the system. Right, so that's probably... No, that's what's on my mind right now of being the next game. Who knows if that'll really happen. Maybe I could build it, and maybe I don't find anything interesting. Maybe I have a really hard time building it. Maybe there's interesting things, but it's hard to do the puzzles. Who knows what's going to happen, but that's kind of the idea right now.
That's a great idea. And as you say, maybe it's interesting because quantum computing is, of course, something that the tech world is going, frankly, apeshit for, trying to figure out, right? Processing things with qubits for really, really quick decryption and things like that. But you're talking more about simulating the actual mode of thinking that quantum mechanics require, where two states can be simultaneously true and things like that, and almost a Portal-style game where instead of interacting with unusual kinds of... Portal or Antichamber or something, where you're...
Maybe more like Space Camp.
Ooh, okay, that's interesting. So that's interesting that I was picturing moving around a physical space in some way, and you were thinking more of like a state diagram almost. That's really cool.
Yeah, I don't really know what this game is going to look like yet, but that seems like a really good way to add value to the world, right? And that's what this is all about. It's not about making cheap entertainment. There's plenty of that out there already, and I'm not very interested in that. I want to add value.
That's a good goal. I would say, and it's a funny thing in technology and in general and games in particular, because everyone states that as their goal, but you strike me as somebody who earnestly wants to do that, right? It's not the, I'm sure you've seen Silicon Valley at least a little bit, the HBO series, where the running gag is every CEO worth his salt claims to want to make the world a better place, right? That's the motivation, right? And that's, it is a good goal, but when that's actually the goal, it's so incredibly vague that unless you put something more specific on it, like teaching about obscure or complicated concepts through game design, that's a real goal. Simply adding value to the world is what everyone should want to do, but is hard to quantify.
Yeah, well, it's hard to find ways to do it that also make money as well. So I think that this one would work for making money, at least enough to sustain myself.
Sure.
Right? So I think there are enough people that would want... that are curious about that would be interested in this kind of game. So I think it hits both areas well enough and a small scale enough to be able to tackle. So
sure,
yeah, about it.
So quick question about just Ludum Games as a team or an organization. How many people are on the team right now? Because the website uses plural pronouns and things. It's you and how many others?
It's I'm the only full-time member of Ludium Games, but I contract other people as necessary.
Gotcha.
Right? So
gotcha.
I didn't want to add like artists to the team or something because I don't always have work for them. So I contracted a 2D artist to do the HUD for Chess 2. I contracted a 3D artist to do the shapes for the pieces. Right now I'm contracting one guy to help me with the iPad port, so that it can come during some of the slower launch seasons, like hopefully next month or the month after, before the big October AAA games come out.
Sure.
Right? But as far as permanent members, it's just myself.
Gotcha. That's an interesting model where you're the nucleus of an ever changing to go back to quantum mechanics, I guess, right? You're the center of a thing that is always changing around you. That's interesting.
It's the only way I know how to do it.
Well, it seems to be working so far. Is the plan for the Steam version to come out when the iOS version comes out? Same deal, kind of beat the fall rush. If you don't want to comment on that, that's obviously fine. But
no, I'd like them to come out as soon as possible. Is the goal. They will come out as soon as they're ready as well.
Great. Yeah, that's again a good philosophy that a lot of people, especially in this era of early access, everybody states, but not everybody follows in fact, right? The idea of it coming out when it's ready, as opposed to when the developer needs money or when articles are hot or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, I need money. That's for sure. And I need to release the game soon.
Sure. Yeah. But fair enough.
Yeah. You can't release something that's broken though. It doesn't work, especially for an online multiplayer game. There's a very high level of tolerance that the game needs to have to continue working, right? You need servers that are online all the time. You need robust interaction between the client and the server. You need to handle all kinds of things that are difficult in programming, like disconnections. How do you handle a game that has been disconnected? Do you let the person reconnect? Do you throw them to the menu? Is that game still rated? There's all kinds of questions there that make it a bit more difficult to release a game, and you need a higher standard of quality, I think, for an online game such as this. So that's kind of what makes it be delayed for a while.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. I mean, there've definitely been... It always strikes me as a very special kind of ambitious for an indie game to have online multiplayer or be centered around it. Because, as you say, there are so many additional moving parts, and it kind of lives and dies by the interest of a fan base, being able to find a match if you're the sort of person who wants somebody random. So that's, that's a big deal, and it kind of is important to have people help get the word out, which, by the way, I'm happy to help with that. Everybody listening, give the game a shot. Is there a plan, by the way, for there to be some form of demo or anything for people to try out? Again, I'm an idiot about this because I don't have an Ouya. Is that the plan, or is it more just watch some videos, decide whether it's for you, and maybe give it a go?
So the way that that it works right now on the Ouya is that the game is free to download, and it gives you 80 crowns. And crowns are the way that you can purchase a game to play. And by a game, I mean like a single match of the game. There aren't any kinds of unlocks. There are no hats. There are no unlocking the armies to play. There are no ways to cheat in the game. Like,
there's no pay to win, in other words.
No pay to win. All of those things I feel really detract from what I feel is the meat of the game, right? I want to sell the meat and potatoes, right? I don't want to be selling the garnish. And I feel that the real value of chess, too, is being able to play against people online. So that's what I'm selling.
Okay. So is the plan for the iPad and the Steam version will then follow a similar free-to-play model? And to go with the food metaphor, is there an all-you-can-eat option? Or is it always buy the game or buy the pack of games?
So that's the way that it is for the Ouya, is that you buy the pack of games. The pack of games, though, happens to be so large that people really... don't get through it. I'd actually designed the pack of games for real-time play, where you'd finish the game in one sitting, but it ended up that asynchronous play is much better. So you end up going through the crowns slower than I anticipated. And even what I had anticipated, the pack is so many crowns that 90% of players would be able to play the game for about like as much as you would be able to play Skyrim or something on $5 worth of crowns. Mm. Right? So it's really very affordable and a good way, I think. And it really aligns developer and player incentives.
That makes sense. I was just going to say that makes sense because if you've played enough, if you put a Skyrim-ish number of hours into a game like this, presumably you're the kind of player who wouldn't mind tossing the developer another $5, right?
Right, that's the idea. And we can do a lot of interesting things with this system that we couldn't do by doing a pay-up-front model. For example, allowing an unlimited number of asynchronous games. If you want to create 100 games, well, you have to pay for them, and that's okay. Because if you're going to pay for them, then you're probably going to come back and play them, right?
Sure, yeah.
We don't have to limit that. There's just a lot of things that really align the developer and player incentives, right? Like, I really want you to come and play the game more. So I want to create a great game. I don't want to, like, trick you with some fancy trailer or anything, because you get free games. You're gonna try it out, and you're going to know if the experience is something that you want to pay for or not. So I want you to love the game as much as possible so that you'll want to spend more money in the game. That's what you want too, right? I think it's a pretty good model. The downside of this model is that for a game that is an indie scale or has an indie scale number of players, it's really, really difficult to make a sustainable income off of this or to sell enough that you can actually afford to make the next game, right? Game development is very expensive. There's software licenses. It takes a lot of time. The server costs more than $100 a month just to keep running. There's lots of expenses that goes into this. And with a free-to-play game, normally the number of people who play the game, is only about 5%. If it's really good, 5% of people who will actually pay for the game. So to offset that, the cost of those other 95% of the people, and to have enough income from those 5%, you either have to make it really expensive for those 5%, or you have to have a huge, huge player base, which is just not feasible for an indie game, right? I don't have a huge advertising budget. I don't have a network of other games that I can have linked to this game and have, like, players from Farmville come over and play the other Zynga game or whatever. So it's going to be very difficult to have that model carry over onto Steam, for example. So for Steam, the thought right now, no promises, I haven't even talked over this with Valve yet, is probably $24 or $24.99 for two copies, or $20 for one copy, or rather $19.99 for one copy.
Sure, sure.
Because that's just a model that works. The game will still be great. Like, I've already tried to make the game as good as possible to sustain that free-to-play model that we talked about before, but it will probably be monetized differently on Steam. And for iPad, I haven't really decided. What I'm thinking right now would work the best for iPad is maybe a dollar up front, but then after that first dollar, continue with the crown system. Mm. So that way, I wouldn't get nothing from the 95%. And when you pay for a game, you kind of commit to it more. I think that Chess 2 is a game where it takes more than 5 minutes to really enjoy the game. You want to spend a while learning the systems. It's not an arcade game, right? It's a deeper kind of game, and paying for a game motivates a player to explore it rather than to give up after the first 2 minutes.
Sure.
So I think that could help there. I'm not sure if that model of paying a dollar up front but then having to continue to pay after is something that players would accept, or if that would lead to bad ratings. I don't know. This is kind of experimental, but I think that's the best if player psychology allows for it. But sometimes players freak out about stuff even when you're doing things in their best interest.
Sure. Well, because there is, after all, a more than cottage industry built around getting players to accept stuff that is not in their best interests and accept it gratefully, right? So the confusion is understandable.
Right.
Sure. Well, good. That's interesting. Well, and I know Frozen Synapse did something similar with I believe the second copy was even free, but the idea of making, you know, if you buy it, then you get a second copy to give to a friend very, you know, either free or very cheaply, makes sense, because that gives people the opportunity to sort of spread the good word while also, as you say, you know, getting them to pay and getting them to invest in the experience and buy into it psychologically as well as financially. Makes sense to me.
Can we pause for a moment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I'll be back in 2 minutes.
Not a problem.
Okay, sorry about that.
Not a problem at all.
Okay, where were we? We were talking about money. And
we were definitely talking about money. Well, and it's good to talk openly about money a little bit, because that's something I know some developers, artists in general, right, shy away from. What some see as the uneasy relationship between art and commerce, right? People get very nervous about that, as though there's a crassness to worrying about getting paid. But and yet they want, you know, people to quit their day jobs and throw themselves at, you know, their projects, right? It's this kind of double punk rock double bind, you might think of it as, right? Where we're all supposed to quit our day jobs and just make whatever we want, but we're never supposed to make money off of it, because that's, you know, that's a crass motivation. It's tough.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know that there's an easy answer, because as you say, there's a non 100% overlap between things that enrich our culture and things that people are usually willing to pay money for.
Right. Yeah. And it's not something I like to talk about as much as game design. I think that game design is a much more important conversation, and something that hopefully I'll have more to add to the conversation about. But it's a really hot topic in the industry right now, especially with free-to-play. A lot of people actually attack free-to-play. I don't hate it, but I hate a lot of free-to-play games, and I think that we really need to take the discussion away from free-to-play and monetization and talk more about predatory business practices, because those are a different thing, and really predatory business practices are what we don't like, and that encompasses even more than free to play. You know, concepts like energy bars and games and things like that don't actually necessarily tie into money, right?
The
money aspect is villainized, really we need to be talking about predatory business practices and money as though they're a separate thing, because free to play is defensible. Right, where the other is not.
Sure. No, and I mean, after all, the example that I think everybody beats up on rightly is Dead Space 3, which uses all of the above. You know, it is a game that costs too much up front and then has microtransactions and, you know, gives you really, really tedious tasks to do, but then lets you pay your way out of them. But you're very right that the tedious tasks are themselves a problem, even if you couldn't pay your way past them, right? Which is the aspect people beat up on the most. But the very idea of exploiting player psychology in pursuit of a level ding or whatever is predatory, and you know predatory is the right word, right? Because you're aggressively eating people's time, which, you know, it's not to get all existential, but you know everyone's time is limited, and you know to have yourself be, I guess, to a certain degree tricked into giving it up on something that is only appearing to give you what you're looking for from it rather than really providing it is really insidious. So I agree with that completely.
Yeah, and I feel much more passionately also about time than I do money. Like everyone really focuses on like games that trick you to give you their money, but really the time is much more important to most people, even though they don't say as much, but they treat it as much. I mean, time is all you have.
Yeah, yeah. The more predatory free-to-play practices, after all, wouldn't work if people valued their money more than they value their time, right? That's the whole game.
Yeah. But yeah, we don't bat an eyelash at many games that have grinding, or an online RPG, or maybe like a Diablo or whatnot. We don't bat an eye at those games. We review them highly, even though they waste a lot of your time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, well, in fact, the backlash against Diablo 3 only happened when they put in microtransactions, right? The auction house, the real money auction house, which is now dead.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know. I feel sick now if I try to play those games. I tried to play Torchlight 2, like when I had a free weekend. I actually feel nauseous after an hour or so. I can't take that anymore. I don't know.
Because of the grindy aspect, you mean?
Yes. Yeah, just the this aspect of this is not really adding value to my life, and I'm just kind of mindlessly clicking. But really, the grindiness, like there are things in that game that I'd like to see, but it's gonna take, you know, hours and hours and hours of me doing dumb stuff that I don't want to do, and just to see that stuff. So.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, yeah, for sure, for sure. And it's an interesting concept to me, because on the one hand, I completely agree with you. I have a similar nausea attached to grinding of all kinds, and there are of course games where grinding is more or less optional. You can execute a playthrough with zero grinding if you apply skill to it, or you can grind to give yourself the statistical advantage to not have to exert quite as much skill, and that's a choice. And that choice itself, you could say, is insidious, but it's there. There are options, right? All of that I agree with and I think about quite a bit. On the other hand, though, it's a tough thing because, you know, is it just junk food, and isn't it okay for people to want junk food sometimes? Obviously, it's bad if that's all you eat. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe I hesitate slightly about the idea that kind of stuff is necessarily bad or immoral. It's bad for you, but things that are bad for you in moderation are, you know, are not an escapable or necessarily, deleterious thing.
I would agree with that. Like, a grind is not necessarily... There are games that I play sometimes just to chill, right? And but when a lot of the games that we're talking about have... an addictive aspect to them, where you end up, and by design, end up spending a lot more time than you intended to, or more time than was good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. There actually wasn't there that big thing where Zynga, it turned out, had a term for it, and they actually called it time destruction or something? Some leaked design document about how a really successful game gets you, like, basically ruins your life even when you're not playing it, because your head is still stuck in the game and you're wondering if your energy bar has recharged or whatever.
Right.
But, yeah. So that's the enemy, right? Free to play is not the enemy. Free to play is just one way of, because again, the core thing is people should make great things, and those who enjoy those things should, you know, perhaps pay something for them so that the people making them can make more great things while also eating. Yeah. It's really not that complicated a thing, but it's all wrapped up in, again, all these you know, I don't know, this hand-wringing stuff about art versus commerce and also, you know, also the fact that the moral argument of piracy has been, you know, that battle's been fought completely wrong, and it's sort of been the availability of peer-to-peer networks has been made the enemy, when in fact the idea of not paying for something is the enemy, right? If somebody plays chess 2 because they torrented it, but then they pay you, then there's no harm done. Whereas if they don't play it at all, but torrent it, that, you know what I'm saying? Like it's the not paying you that does harm. It's not the actual technology. And then also there's just the totally good faith thing that we have way too much entertainment. And it can be really hard to decide what to, not too much, right, but quite a lot, right? It can be hard to decide what to spend your money on. So all of that stuff combined can make it very complicated to talk about this stuff and not sound like you're money grubbing or whatever.
Yep.
That was me talking at you for a minute, which is bad podcasting etiquette, so I apologize for
that. No, it's adding to the conversation, right? I'm sure the listeners would want to hear.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the piracy thing is interesting to me, right? Because it's I feel like I harp on it a little bit on the podcast and elsewhere, but it's really important, I think, for people to understand that, you know, in the classic example of there are a lot of bands I go see and give money to and buy music from that I would not have known about had I not initially downloaded their stuff illegally. And that isn't – there's nothing morally problematic about that. You know, it – I don't know. It's not a technology problem. It's a being fair problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're a high school student, you can pirate my games because you have no job.
There you go. Yeah, but if you're right, totally. But if you, by the way, as I am, are, you know, a person in their 20s or 30s who has income, then support the things you love. It's really not that complicated.
Yeah, please do.
And take a chance on things you might love. You know, that's the other big thing.
Or if Chess 2 ever falls off the radar and is no longer available on any platforms, then pirate it.
There you go. Totally. So that's the other thing, right? That's the other thing that makes the moralizing, I should say, argument about piracy disingenuous, right? That means that the people who are saying piracy is bad and the enemy aren't arguing in good faith. A huge quantity of the stuff I pirate because I can't get it other ways, or at least it's incredibly expensive or inconvenient to get it other ways. If something's been out of print for a while, then yes, absolutely, pirate it. That's how, you know, like, I don't know, especially with games, like, I feel like most people who know the canon really well played a lot of it on emulators, and again, I don't really know what's wrong with that. Yeah, especially back in the day when, you know, there was no virtual console and things like that, and that was how you got to it. There's a huge amount of video game history that's still really only accessible that way.
Yeah, actually, funny you brought that up. One of the most common uses of the Ouya right now is for emulators, so...
That makes complete sense to me. I mean, and
I'm not to endorse that publicly, you know, but, you know, on the record here.
No, sure. No, I mean, well, let's be clear. Neither you nor I have ever actually pirated anything.
Of course not.
No, definitely not.
In high school and not now.
No, definitely not. We use peer-to-peer software purely for open-source software and nothing else. No question.
Right. And Overclocked Remix.
Yes, that of course. Goes without saying, which is awesome, by the way. And legitimately something I use torrents for a lot. But yeah, it is interesting, the emulator thing. Because I was reading somewhere, and I would need to check whether this is true, but I believe that no game has ever entered the public domain. Some people have released games into the public domain when they were first made, but it has never been the case that someone held a copyright on a game and then it passed into public domain the way you know, songs sometimes do or whatever.
Sure, that takes like 70 years or something.
Well, yeah. Thanks to Disney, now it does. Yeah, it didn't used to be that way, but that's a frightening thought, right? Because I mean, I bring this up because you are, after all. You are making a thing that is based on a thing made beginning from something that is in the public domain, namely chess. And I think what you're doing is valuable, and I think the original design of the game, I'm sorry if I'm going to mispronounce his name, David Serlin is the guy who designed Chess 2, right?
That's correct.
So that's valuable. That kind of remixing is a really important thing to be able to do, and if chess had been created under the regime of modern intellectual property law, that would literally not be possible, or it would be at the mercy of complicated licensing agreements at the very least.
There's a very fundamental problem with copyright law, and that is based on copying. That doesn't make any sense at all, because information is something that wants to copy itself. Every time that someone plays this podcast, they're making a copy of audio that then like streams out into the universe and goes and makes copies of itself when it bounces off things. It doesn't make any sense. They make several copies when it goes through the internet connection to their hard drive, they make a copy in the RAM, they make all kinds of copies. So to base intellectual property law on copying is kind of a madness. I mean, really, the laws have become extremely technical, where software license agreements do state in them that you are allowed to make a copy on your hard drive and then RAM and then CPU. But what if the underlying technology changes, right? And there's a lot of weird, nonsensical cases that aren't allowed right now by our copyright laws. Like if I have a DVD, a completely legitimate copy of a DVD, and it gets scratched or something, I can't go download that online. That is illegal. Why? That doesn't make any sense. And it's because all of the foundation of our law is based on copying. What are you allowed to copy? What are you allowed to distribute? If there's another idea out there, I'd like to hear it. I don't know what other options there are for a foundation of intellectual property law. But I know that copyright is like a pretty bonkers idea.
I would like very much for Creative Commons to be the answer. I don't copyright anything on this podcast or this blog, by the way. It's all Creative Commons. But because that hasn't really gone to court yet, right? There hasn't been a case that went all the way where someone infringed on something protected under Creative Commons, and then the creator of it, was able to pursue that based on Creative Commons. Like, it's untested, so I don't know, right? Because that's the legitimate use of copyright law and trademarking and so on, is if I make something and someone else claims they made it and tries to make a profit, we should be able to stop that. But it's morphed into this thing that is primarily, as you say, about consumers making copies of things, which was never actually a threat to commercial interests. And, you know, in this age of distributed networks and things like that, may actually mostly be of benefit to commercial interests. There was this case recently about, what was it called? I'm an idiot for blanking on this. The thing that broadcast TV networks over the internet. What was that piece of technology called? Did you follow this?
No.
Well, I'm a jerk and I'll look it up. But anyway, it was a device that grabbed terrestrial, TV broadcasts and then let you access the ones from your area over the internet. And they were very careful. They tried to do it above board and only broadcast stuff from your area, so you still saw local ads and things. But the highest court in the land found that this was basically piracy. And the thing is, if you as a...
It doesn't make any sense.
It makes no sense, because the thing is, if you as a TV... Television is ad-supported, right? So if more eyeballs are on your ad, and in your head you're making less money, you're terrible at your job, right? Like, there's no justification for that.
So I guess, the one thing that I can think of there is maybe the TV networks wouldn't have accurate statistics anymore about who's watching. Like certain TVs have chips in them that save what you watched, so they wouldn't be able to get access to that data anymore. But still, like, I don't know.
Well, Aereo, by the way, is what it was called. Aereo is the name of the technology, and they basically just they did the same thing that people do when they pirate cable, right? They just they pointed a bunch of dishes at at the source and then rebroadcast it. But yeah, the point you're making would be a 100% legitimate point if they knew who was watching now. But they sort of refuse to use digital means to figure out who's watching TV. They still rely on Nielsen ratings, which have never been logical or accurate. They're kind of a random sampling. So, right. I don't know. If anything, this would make it easier to know who's watching. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they could easily make an agreement with them to just to give them the data about how often
Right. Somebody's
watched. And right. Then they would have more value. They could gather value from that. But I guess in this case, it is kind of important that the law gives the broadcasting agencies control here, and that they'd at least be able to ask for the data, right? Like they have control, and that they can make an agreement with them in a way that benefits the broadcasting companies. Like I'm kind of in favor with that.
Yeah.
In this case, like it doesn't make much sense.
Yeah.
But I can imagine a case where it would make sense. And it's
sure.
Okay.
No, I get that, the law always has to be very steeped in and concerned with precedent. But it's just – it gets to be frustrating when the interests that are upheld are those of these kind of, dinosaur-like broadcasting companies that own huge swaths of spectrum and such that they did not pay for but were given in a supposed public interest, right? That gets to be a little bit maddening. But you're right. It's not as though it's an open and shut case or that there aren't – I get it from the point of view of an old media distributor that this is a scary time to be an old media distributor, right?
Absolutely.
I fully understand that, and I sympathize with it. But at the same time, it's hard to feel sympathy for a gigantic interest that is stomping all over innovation in this case, right? It's hard to see it any other way than that.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, we're way off on a tangent, which is fun.
Yeah, the games.
It's right. Well, that's. I mean, we wanted to not talk about commerce. We wanted to talk about design. But they're. I think where we ended up is that they're not separable or not completely separable. It's part of designing something ethically is that you thought about your monetization model in your case, and you thought about how not to have it intrude with what you wanted to do in the game, while also allowing you to pay rent and eat and things. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? Not thinking about that is the problem. Thinking about it is not a problem. It seems to me.
I agree.
Yeah.
Or I wouldn't have thought about it.
Fair enough. And you certainly wouldn't have talked about it with me. So thanks for doing that. So you've been really generous with your time. I will not take up any more of it. Thank you again for joining me here. And best of luck with the port and all of that.
Oh, thank you.
Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye.
And that's the show. Thank you once again for being here, and thanks once again to Zach Burns for speaking with me. You can get the digital version of Chess 2 on Ouya or Steam right now, and soon you'll be able to get it on iPad as well. So do check it out. I think it's hugely interesting. Come play a game with me. Additionally, if you want to follow Zach, you can do so at Ludium Games. You can also follow me on Twitter, which I never say this. Why don't I? You can follow me at Drew M. Michaels, and you can follow Lucio at Bold Boognish. Additionally, you can subscribe to this podcast using good old-fashioned RSS or anything that RSS can attack and colonize and control, such as iTunes, Stitcher, Podbay, etc. Pro tip, by the way, if you podcast on WordPress.com, the default settings will only RSS stream your last 10 posts, for example, the last 10 episodes of your podcast. That's not cool. If you want it to show everything, which, spoiler alert, you do, you can change that setting. I just saved you some time. Anyway, thank you very much once again for being here. If you want to subscribe to this podcast, you can also play a game of chess 2 physically. You have to be playing as the Two Kings army. Your opponents need to be the Animals army. You need to perform a whirlwind on the Jungle Queen, and then the board will begin to spontaneously cast a pod at you. etao.wordpress.com